All right, this afternoon we only have one case on our 1:30 docket. We have Whitney versus State. If the clerk will please announce counsel. All right, Mr. Harris, I hope you didn't get that injury this morning.
Oh, Lord, no. I've been working on this. This is an improvement. I'm not out on a pillow like this as I started out, you know.
Yeah.
I actually got a tie on for y'all. You're the first court I've managed to do that in a month.
Well, we appreciate it.
Well, you came well armed.
So. Oh.
Oh.
Well, my worthy opponent suggested I was trying to curry sympathy, but... I haven't gotten much of that at home, so I don't expect much here either. May it please the court, good afternoon. I represent Tyra Ann Whitney, a person who relocated here from New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, who was convicted of murder, the murder of the boyfriend of her daughter who had a very tempestuous relationship. There are three issues raised in the case, and with the court's permission, I'll submit the third one on the brief. I want to make a brief reference to the second issue and just to make a quick response to the state's argument that it is inadequately briefed. I would point out that it raises an issue that really is fairly new, and that is the question of whether or not the omission of the duty to retreat that previously existed in the self-defense statute creates a problem when there's a reference in another part of the charge and in the statute to when you don't have a duty to retreat. The Murphy case, which the state cited, in that instance, the failure to adequately brief, the Court of Criminal Appeals said that counsel had failed to cite any constitutional or statutory authority for the position that he or she argued. In this instance, though the authority is sparse, I do have one case and a couple of references to statutes. So I would suggest that it's a little bit novel, and I would also argue it's not a policy argument so much as a question of what is the law harmed sufficiently that it becomes a problem because of the way the legislature drafted the change.
And the charge was requested at trial, correct?
It was, and I agree with the state. The court did track the statute as it currently exists. Turning now to the first issue, the first issue is a Sixth Amendment question. At trial, Wes Bearden, who's a licensed attorney and who was actually appointed in this case to assist me as my investigator, because he runs an investigation agency as well, was asked by me and my client to serve as pro bono co-counsel during the trial of the case. The court introduced him as co-counsel on the beginning of the voir dire process. The next day, she informed me that Judge Wilson, who she was sitting for, this was Judge Pavlik, that Judge Wilson had ordered her not to allow him to participate actively in the trial. I objected under the Sixth Amendment. And I'm aware that this court has the Trammell decision that I will get to in just a moment. But I want to start with actually a case that's not directly about that, and that's Stearns versus Clinton. Stearns versus Clinton is a case that argues for the importance of the independence of defense counsel. There are lots of cases that make reference to it, but Stearns versus Clinton is an interesting instance in which the judge out in Lubbock was mandamus because he had basically taken a defense attorney off the case for having conducted an interview with a witness in violation of a rule propounded by the local district attorney. Now, it's the thing that's instructive about Stearns is it really explains how important the independence of defense counsel is. The role of the judge should be to act as a judge, to moderate, to be even-handed with both sides, not to interfere with how competent, I'm going to entertain the suggestion that I was, counsel conducts their defense. In this instance, I was the court-appointed counsel. Mr. Bearden was not on the wheel, but he is licensed by the Supreme Court, and the government code says that the power to determine the qualifications of lawyers in this state is vested solely with the Supreme Court and may not be delegated by the Supreme Court to another authority.
Therefore, we can't have the wheel?
I think that's an interesting question, Your Honor, And I really don't think the facts in this case raise that issue directly. I know Judge Wilson would love to have me suggest that 2604 is unconstitutional, but I don't think in this set of facts that issue is before the court. What's before the court is whether or not the trial court can interfere in these circumstances with a defense counsel's choice to use a pro bono counsel to assist him in trial. You know, there are lots of reasons why you'd want a second counsel, and that's certainly not something that's lost on the state, because they always try cases with two attorneys at the prosecution table. And there are so many different advantages that gives you in terms of how you conduct the case and how you go through it. Now, the primary concern, I think, of most of the cases dealing with this is the question of what happens.
You just said, I know I let you start talking before. You said, you implied a minute ago that you wanted Mr. Bearden, whereas I thought that the issue was phrased, does an accused person have a right? So who is it that wanted Mr. Bearden? You did?
Well, I did originally, and I suggested to my client that I would like for him to participate.
Okay.
And we asked her on the record, did she want that, and she said yes. She wouldn't have known Mr. Bearden from Adam's cat otherwise. Getting back to this, I think that most of the concern about whether or not a person who is indigent gets to make a choice about their attorney has revolved around the problems that occur when you allow indigent persons to demand their own attorney, either who they ask for, their use of it as a stalling procedure to prevent going to trial, wanting to change attorneys at the last moment, which is common. That wasn't involved here. The most recent case out of the Supreme Court, of course, is United States versus Gonzalez-Lopez. And the language is pretty clear. They talk about the fact that originally ineffective assistance is judged as it was originally something that sprang from the Due Process Clause. The Sixth Amendment is different. It means more than just a fair trial. It means that is the way that a fair trial is to be achieved. As a matter of fact, what they say is the right to select a counsel of one's choice, by contrast, has never been derived from the Sixth Amendment's purpose of ensuring a fair trial. It has been regarded as the root meaning of the constitutional guarantee itself. In that case, as the court knows, they had a situation where a federal judge was confronted with a local appointed counsel and a retained counsel. I believe there was a counsel from out of state that the defendant wanted, and the court refused to let him participate and didn't grant him the right to do so, and went so far as to position a marshal between him and the counsel during the trial and ordered him not to have any conversations with trial counsel until after the trial. This was held to violate the Sixth Amendment. And really what we come to in this case is the question of, does the situation that is recognized by the federal precedents before this case, including Wheat and several of the other federal cases, that a court-appointed lawyer is not something that an indigent gets to choose? Well, in this case, Ms. Whitney didn't get to choose me. She was stuck with me, and I was appointed. The choice to have co-counsel, I would understand that if I asked the court to appoint him, he was not on the wheel. He's qualified as an attorney, but he's not on the appointment wheel. So I don't believe she could have appointed him under this statute. But he was willing to serve as counsel without charge. And this is the place where I think Trammell is wrongly decided, frankly. You know, first off, in Trammell, there is, like this case, a licensed, experienced attorney willing to volunteer her time pro bono. The balance of who had more experience weighs more on my side than Mr. Bearden's, but that's the only really major distinction there. The use of Mr. Bearden as co-counsel would not have delayed the trial. We were ready to go forward. It wasn't going to postpone anything. It was not a situation where Ms. Whitney was trying to get rid of one attorney. It did not, and I think in this respect, Trammell is mistaken. In Trammell, one of the things the court held was the fact that there was a pro bono counsel willing to work with the appointed counsel was an indication that the defendant was no longer indigent. I don't think that has anything to do, I would submit, with indigency. As long as that counsel is not charging anything, you know, free counsel is free counsel. Ms. Whitney was just as poor before Mr. Bearden volunteered as she was after. And, of course, the statute says that a presumption of indigency maintains throughout the representation unless something is brought to the court's attention that is a change of circumstances in the financial circumstance of the defendant.
But I think one of the issues that came up in Trammell was how can you justify retaining appointed counsel that a county office is going to have to fund and pay for if there is then in turn a volunteer attorney. Now, in your situation, I guess someone who was volunteering was not qualified to handle the case alone.
Well, as a matter of law, in terms of his licensure, he was, but uh-huh. a matter of the Fair Defense Act, he was not. And I think that, yes, there's an administrative issue here. Mm-hmm. How do we qualify people to get on the wheel if we don't let them participate in cases with senior counsel when they are not otherwise qualified?
And it also seems backwards from, I guess, all of the mandates to volunteer to do pro bono work. You know, it's obviously a goal of the Texas Supreme Court and the State Bar of Texas.
Your Honor, I think that's correct. And I think the other thing that's different is that, as I said, there's a lot of value in having co-counsel in any trial, regardless of which side you're on. And that is something that I try to, for example, what we teach commonly to defense attorneys around this state is don't ever pick a jury by yourself. You can't do it competently. You need a second person, preferably a lawyer or a jury selection expert with you. Now, what I would...
Is it true that this individual was allowed to consult with you, just not actively participate in front of the jury in the trial?
Yes, ma'am. That is correct. He was able to talk with me. He was allowed, unlike the situation in Trammell, he was allowed to sit at counsel table with me. He took notes. We talked about things. He consulted with me in talking with the defendant from time to time.
So you got the benefit of all that. The only thing that this person couldn't do is actually stand up in court and present something to the court or the jury.
Yes, ma'am. And, you know, one of the things that's a theme that runs through Gonzalez-Lopez and other cases is that part of the reason that this is a structural issue is that you don't know what intangible thing that other counsel might have brought to the case that might have made a difference to the jury. And, you know, the Supreme Court has taken the position that it will not speculate on that because it would just be an endless speculation on both sides.
It seems to me that we keep coming back really to the wheel. He was not allowed to participate because he wasn't on the wheel. So that's the only reason that he wasn't allowed to participate. And so it seems to me that we keep coming back to that question, the legitimacy of representing somebody if you're not or are on the wheel.
Well, I would argue that it's not necessarily necessary to resolve this case to attack either the wheel or qualifications for appointed counsel. There were good things to be achieved in that. I think the issue is if you've got somebody pro bono willing to help you and it's not going to cost the county and it's not going to delay the trial and it's not hybrid representation, those are not issues. Some of the cases cited in Trammell go off and they're pre-Gonzalez-Lopez cases. I don't think it's just, I mean, the wheel, 2604 doesn't say that he's disqualified. He's disqualified to be appointed.
Well, do we know that's why she didn't allow it? Is because he wasn't on the wheel, or did she not allow it because of the belief that you're not entitled to both a court-appointed attorney that the county is paying if you can have someone do it pro bono? Which of those two reasons do we know was the reason?
Judge, I can only say on the record, what's in your record before you is going to be the comments that Judge Pavlik made about the things that Judge Wilson said to her. I have personal knowledge of her thoughts, and I, you know, I'll just say that, you know, that's not in the record, so I don't know that you could consider that. The express reason in the record is his not being on the wheel. And I don't see anything about 2604 that disqualifies a lawyer that's willing to serve pro bono. And I would urge the court to keep in mind that there are a lot of times that a lawyer might serve pro bono as co-counsel with somebody that's been at it a while that wouldn't want to take it on pro bono as the sole counsel or as lead counsel.
Well, if you had decided to withdraw and Mr. Bearden serve as her only counsel pro bono, I don't think she could have precluded him from doing that.
No, of course she could not. She could choose not to allow me to withdraw too on the eve of trial, and that would be my expectation.
Let's say you'd never been appointed, and he had come in there at first appearance and said, "I represent her. I'm doing it pro bono, but I represent her." There would have been nothing to preclude that.
I think you're absolutely right, Your Honor. In that circumstance, he would have been completely qualified under our laws to represent her. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Harris. Mr. Miskunis, did I say that correctly? Sort of. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. The state is going to rely on the decision in Trammell for its argument. This court has ruled on this exact issue. The appellant has not presented any authority that should compel this court to overrule its prior decision. The Gonzalez-Lopez case, this court specifically said in Trammell that Gonzalez-Lopez does not stand for what appellant says that it stands for. And the question at issue here is, does a defendant have a right to appointed counsel and pro bono counsel of choice? This court has answered that question, and the answer was no. And again, I would simply point out that appellant has not brought before this court any reason to overturn your past decision. As far as point of error two goes.
Well, let me be the devil's advocate. I sort of hear Mr. Harris saying, look, if Mr. Bearden could appear pro se and represent this individual and not be on the wheel as lead counsel, he certainly should be able to appear pro se, not be on the wheel as co-counsel.
But the defendant in this case already had appointed counsel.
But the reason that was articulated that Mr. Bearden couldn't participate was that he was not on the wheel, which I thought I just heard Mr. Harris articulate that if he was pro bono, it didn't make any difference whether he was on the wheel or not. So that seemingly on its face couldn't be a legitimate reason for exclusion. Am I missing something?
Pardon me. Part of the holding in Trammell that this court held was that the judge can allow it. The judge is not required to allow it. And appellant hasn't pointed out any requirement.
Well, let me just ask you, if a licensed lawyer, you know, practicing Tarrant County, wishes to appear for a criminal defendant pro se, volunteer, give up his time, is he required to be on the wheel as a prerequisite to representing the appropriate defendant?
I can't answer that.
Okay.
Again, I would simply rely on the holding in Trammell. It says the judge can allow it. The judge is not required to allow it. In point of error two, I would simply say that the jury charge did track the statutory language. I've provided authority to the court that states that when a jury charge tracks statutory language, there is no error. And I would, like appellant, I will submit point of error three on my brief. If there are no other questions, I will concede the rest of my time to the court. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. All right, Mr. Harris, rebuttal.
Try to give the court some change. I agree. Trammell is really the issue before this court. It's the court's own precedence. I think that there's a distinction to be made, and when Gonzalez-Lopez talks about the distinction that court-appointed cases are different and that the rule's a little different there, I believe that what they mean to be referring to is that if it's the court's nickel, the court gets to choose. They have said in their other precedents that either retain counsel, if a defendant can hire them, you've got to give it to them, or pro bono counsel, if the defendant wants them, to the exclusion of that appointed counsel. Again, the Sixth Amendment requires that you allow them to be the lead counsel. Now here, we've got an appointed counsel seeking to use a pro bono counsel to assist him in the trial, but fully participate as a lawyer. You know, Gonzalez-Lopez notes that the Sixth Amendment requires that you allow a defendant to represent him or herself pro se, and that's hardly ever a good thing, you know, in terms of the outcome of the trial or the headache it creates for the trial judge, but it's mandated by the Sixth Amendment, and I think that that's instructive here. A couple of the cases that the court referred to in Trammell, Montemayor v. State, that was a matter where the court approved removing appointed counsel when another lawyer was retained. And because of the retention, clearly that was a situation where the court could hold that the defendant was no longer indigent. Hazelwood versus State is another recitation of the rule that a defendant in our state is not entitled to hybrid representation. He can't be his own lawyer and have a lawyer at the same time. Again, not an issue that is raised here. The bottom line is, my position is that the Sixth Amendment of the United States Constitution mandates that if this is a choice that does not do any of the things this one didn't do, it doesn't delay the trial, it doesn't cost the state anything, the lawyer is duly qualified. You know, in Gonzalez-Lopez, that lawyer was not qualified to participate in the federal district, and I don't know if it's the northern or southern of Missouri, because he wasn't admitted there. But in this instance, we had a lawyer that was admitted and was licensed in this state for that court. So he was qualified, and I just submit that this is an unfortunate interference with the independent execution of the role of defense counsel. I think the court should re-examine Trammell and consider that in these circumstances, when they occur, the Sixth Amendment does mandate the choice of the defendant. As long as the defendant says, yes, I want that attorney, this is not somebody that this court-appointed attorney is just foisting off on me, then I think the Sixth Amendment entitles them to that choice. Thank you.
All right, gentlemen, thank you so much for your arguments today and your briefing in this matter. Your case is now submitted, and we will now adjourn court.